little background about Christian Mitchell. He was raised in Maywood. He's a former community organizer with the Southside Organized for Unity. He graduated from the University of Chicago.
He did.
All right. And he was elected in 2012, so he's still relatively new. All right. Let's give it up for him.
All righty. Thank you, everyone. I see some familiar faces, not all of whom are just turning 18, but I am grateful to be here this evening. I will be relatively brief because I'd love to take some questions. So I want to start off by saying that I know that there are some folks in this room, especially some of our younger folks, who you see people up here in suits, and it seems like we were born in them. Like, this is how we kind of all started out. But it's not the case. And for me, life has been no crystal stair. There have been boards torn up and nails in it. I was raised by a single mom, as Anthony said, in Maywood. Only child of a single mom, dealt with two very sick grandparents when I was younger. Helped to care for them while I was going through high school. And when I was 9 years old, I had an aunt who was wrongfully convicted of a crime, convicted of murder, sentenced to 25 to life in prison, exonerated 4 years later, but not before it turned our lives upside down. Not before my grandmother went into Alzheimer's, and my grandfather went from second to third stage congestive heart failure. It changed our lives forever, and it's, I think, what set me down the path towards social justice. My mother had invested heavily in my education, and because of that, I was able to get the University of Chicago on scholarship. Now, this is the part where I tell you that I always wanted to be in public service, but I initially wanted to become a really successful lawyer and buy my mom a new house and buy 3 cars and marry Alicia Keys. I'm a little off the beaten path, and she went and got married on me, but that was kind of the original plan. But it was there that I actually met John Easton, who was a community organizer. He worked with the Metropolitan Alliance of Congregations. And John taught me that it wasn't good enough for me to succeed. I had to help others. I had to lift as I climbed. And so when I graduated from the University of Chicago, I went straight into community organizing. Did it for 3 years. Worked on the Olympic bid down in the Kenwood Oakland area and across the South Side, making sure there'd be community benefits, working on creating jobs and weatherization for folks who looked like me and folks all across the city of Chicago. And working, fighting back when it was House Bill 174 for education funding reform to make sure that a kid's zip code wasn't determining their access to good education. And it was that path that led me into public office, because I saw what we were doing in organizing, and I thought that we needed to get some organizers into the General Assembly. So that's why I ran in 2010. And since I got to the General Assembly, that has been my guiding light, my belief that the ticket that you draw in the lottery of birth should only determine where you start, but should never determine where you finish. And that means making sure that you're safe going to and from school, that our elderly are safe going in and out of their homes, that people who are going to and from work have a safe community, that we have the kind of investments in infrastructure, early childhood education, and college affordability that make sure that anybody who wants a job and is willing to work can have one. And making sure that a kid in Winnetka doesn't get twice as much money to go to school as a kid in the city of Chicago, because we base our system on property taxes, as Will alluded to. That's guided my work in the General Assembly. And I'm honored to have the opportunity to continue doing that. And that's why I'm running for re-election. There's more work to do on all of these issues. But on these issues, I have been a strong fighter for the communities that I've served, for the communities in this city. And what I want to say to all of you who are just voting for the first time is, it really matters. What happens in Springfield really matters for your life. Making sure that we equitably fund education matters for your life. Making sure that we make those key investments matters. And part of what we've seen in our politics is that the lack of involvement, the lack of engagement, has fundamentally changed our public sphere. And that you're being here, you're being willing to come out, you're being willing to vote, you're being willing to register others, you are going to help us reclaim our democracy. So I'm quite honored to be here, very, very grateful. You know, I have another event, but certainly want to take some questions before I go. Thank you guys so much for having me, and I'd love to take some questions.
Because of particular schedule, we're going to field questions for Christian Mitchell now. So if you have any, please. Chris?
No, I want to get somebody who has
time. Oh, okay.
A person with the Say J sign. Let's do you.
My name is Alfonso Jones, and based on what you just said, then you know how it is to grow up indigent.
Sure.
and struggle for your parents to struggle through life and all that, right? Well, let me ask you, why would you cut the pensions of people who worked all their lives to try to have something at the end that would support them throughout the rest of their life? Could you explain, give your reasoning for cutting the pension of people who have worked to earn this money and now you're taking it away?
Sure. So let me say a couple things. First of all, this is not an issue that's impersonal for me. I talked about my mother and the role that she played in my life. So in 2007, my mother's a nurse, and she had been on her job for 27 years at that point. She's now over 30. And in 2007, right before the market crashed, they switched everyone who had been in a defined benefit plan but had been there less than 30 years over to a defined contribution plan. So my mother lost 60% of her value as she's approaching retirement. So this is something that I feel intimately. At the same time, is it illustrative that on the same day that reform was passed in Springfield saving defined benefit plans in the state of Illinois at 80 cents on the dollar, a judge in Detroit adjudicated that they could get 10. But this was not a situation like immigration reform or marriage equality where if we just waited long enough, the right public policy prescription would come along and we could somehow do this in a way that would leave everybody absolutely whole. This was a situation where every day this was growing by $5 million, which meant that ultimately what happened was going to mean less money for our annuitants if we did not act now. So the act that we took was to stop the bleeding, was to stop a situation where this bill had gone down, which, by the way, is why Bruce Rauner was making calls against the bill on the floor, so that when we get, if we got a Republican governor or if this bill went down, it could be draped around the neck of the Democratic legislature, shrink the majority. And then what you see is a situation where the system's so underfunded that everybody decides we're going to throw them all into 401ks. So I did not like having to take that vote, but I took that vote to save pensions and to make sure that people got most of what they earned, because 100% of zero is zero, and zero is where we were headed.
We have a lot of hands going up at one time. I want to give Amanda in the back a chance to speak. We're gonna go in this order. We're gonna go man with the hat, young man in front of him.
I live in the district.
And then the guy who lives in the district.
So my question is, you know, you talk about the path of social justice, and I appreciate your work as a community organizer. But my question is, you also talk about the importance of education, and I'm wondering where you were during school closures when Jay and Will were out fighting school closures. Why were you silent when the schools for these kids are getting closed?
Yeah.
Where were you?
Yeah, so education.
Let's be clear. First of all, this wasn't an issue of silence or not. Let's be clear on what happened in the 26th district. We had three consolidations, Pershing West and East, Dumas into Wadsworth, Fermi, which is in the same building, into itself. In no case did kids move more than a block and a half. In every case, receiving school got better, got investments. Now, I don't like closings. Let's be clear on this. I don't like consolidations. But here are a couple of the facts, and then let's talk about the real problem. So the first fact is that we lost 180,000 African Americans over the last 10 years. And in part, we have not made the key investments in our city that we need to make. And when what happened on education more broadly is this conversation that Will started and that I'm going to finish about education funding reform, something that I've been a leader on since it was House Bill 174 when I was a community organizer. Because what we have right now is a situation where if you live in Winnetka, you get $26,000 a year to go to school. In Chicago, you get about $13,000-$14,000 if you're lucky. Now, myself and Senator Menard from downstate have advanced a report that's about to become a bill that would say property taxes will no longer determine your access to a high-quality public education. And that is our fundamental problem. That's what led us to the situation where we got where we were. There was never a bill on the floor of the House to vote for. Let's be clear on that as well. But now we have a chance to reform the way we fund our public education. That's the thing I fought for, and that is the thing that's going to make the difference across the spectrum. For everyone in education, we're going to free up local property tax dollars that can go toward after-school programs. It can go toward early childhood education. It can go toward making sure that we can pay our teachers a competitive salary. That's the ultimate answer to your question. That's what I've been fighting for.
All right, before we move out, quick note. I want
to... Just to answer what, a muttered comment I heard, I'm actually one of three co-sponsors on elected
after
school board right now. I make all of my decisions based
Christian,
on...
No, I didn't.
Let's be clear. If we're going to have this... So, Shannon...
Excuse me. Hey, everybody.
I'm going to finish my sentence, because this is a full and open democracy. I make my decisions on public policy based on talking to my constituents and doing what's right for them. And when I talked to folks, they made it clear that it was important to support this bill, and that's why I'm supporting it. Be clear.
All right, excuse me. I just want to remind everybody this will not be a shouting match. This is not the forum for that. You're going to raise your hands, and we will call on you as we see you. If you have more, if you have need for more spirited debate, please do that on your own time. All right, we're gonna bounce around. I'm gonna get the young man who said he was from the district, and then you have been very eagerly raising your hand. You will be next.
Thank you. This question is in reference to campaign financing. There is a lot of conversation, I would say, around your first election. And the sources that be that are supporting you in this election. And I think that a lot of people are concerned about how do they know that you're not beholden to sort of the same establishment, and how do they know that you're going to sort of vote independently on issues that matter to them and that are really important, particularly as, you know, as it relates to things like pensions.
So let's be clear. When people contribute to my campaign, my assumption is that they're contributing because they believe in good governance, they believe in somebody who's going to give them all sides of an issue a fair hearing, and that's what it's been reflected in my record in Springfield. So, for example, a lot of, you know, some of the wealthier folks who give to campaign, some of whom give to my campaign, might not like, or might like the plan proposed by the Speaker of the House on cutting the corporate income tax by $1.5 billion. The night that was proposed, I happened to be on television talking about my fight for a fair tax, a progressive income tax in the state of Illinois. And I said openly, look, you know, I have respect for the Speaker of the House. I disagree with this. I think it's the wrong direction. So I got some pushback on that, but it's the right thing to do for my constituents. That same group of folks would be concerned about something that could potentially raise their top marginal tax rate. But I'm strongly supportive of that because I believe we're a demand-side economy. When you put more money back in the hands of working people who are going to go spend it in the middle class, they're going to go to the local grocer, they're going to go to the local small business, they're going to go to the local pharmacist, they're going to spend it there. That's good for our economy, it's good for everyone. So when you look at my record, I make my decisions based on what's best for my constituents, based on my public policy beliefs, and I'll continue to do that.
We're closing soon.
You had a question?
Yes. My question is to you is how come we only... I voted for you in the last election, which I'm very sorry I did. Because as of when you won, I have not seen you one time until this election is coming up again. Mm-hmm. Here you come around, haven't did anything for the 26th district at all. Mm-hmm. While you stand here and put all these glory reports on you, the people of the 26th district have not seen that, because I haven't lived in the 26th district for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And this is the second time I ever seen you.
So,
and that's when you coming around again saying vote for me.
Well,
but your policy, you keep standing here saying what you all you have done. Mm-hmm. Now, I've been in Springfield. Mm-hmm. You're not talking to anybody that don't go to Springfield. Mm-hmm. All these votes that you say you cast for the people in the 26th, you don't even talk to the people in the 26th.
So, ma'am, I respect you know, your opinion, and I'm sorry that we apparently have not seen each other. But here's what's true. Every weekend when I'm back from Springfield, remember we are in Springfield 6 months a year, I'm out knocking and walking and talking to people in the district on, I want to say the third Monday every month, we do an open house in my office, which is the very midpoint of the district where people can come in and ask their concerns. And when I'm out talking to voters on the doors, a lot of them are actually quite pleased with the stuff I'm doing in Springfield. And they talk about, you know, kind of rhetoric versus results. And you know, what I've done is I said, I grew up in Maywood, I live in Bronzeville, I hear gunshots every night. I'm going to do something about that when I get to Springfield. It is now law that we can crack down on straw buyers who are taking guns and selling them to these gangs. That's law in my first year. I said, that we were going to expand health care because growing up with a mother who was a nurse and two sick grandparents, we were going to make sure that more people had that kind of access. And in my first year, we have passed a bill to put 500,000 new people on Medicaid. I said I was going to lead the fight on education funding reform. We've got a bill that's about to come to the floor. So when the people of the 26th district have asked me to deliver results, I've been able to do that, and I'm honored to have the support of the people in this district, but I'm going to keep moving forward with the things they care about. But I thank you for your question. I appreciate your opinion.
Can you tell us, you've just gone over some of the things that you've done since you've been in Springfield?
Yeah, I mean, we've gotten quite a bit done, and there's quite a bit more that we're fighting for. So I was the first African-American co-sponsor on marriage equality, which is now the law of the land. So people can now marry you. And fundamentally, here's another example of independence. I got in a pretty big fight with the fifth floor, that being the mayor of the city of Chicago, on mandatory minimums. And that bill, there was a bill on the floor that would have increased minimum penalties. I pushed back on it, and now we're having a conversation in Springfield for the first time where what we're saying on criminal justice is, you want to have a conversation about cracking down on violent criminals? Let's have that conversation. We all want them off the street. But by the way, we're going to stop treating the public health problem of drug addiction as a public safety problem.
Amen.
We're going to start making sure that drug users and the mentally ill, as your question addressed before, are getting the treatment that they need rather than clogging up our jails. $143 a day when we could be treating them for about 50 and saving room for the violent offenders who are shooting up our community. So we changed the conversation. I've got three bills moving on that right now, and a pact that says we're not going to move anything on criminal justice doesn't include decreasing penalties for nonviolent offenders. So once again, I have said there are things I want to do, and we're working on them, and we've made real progress in the time I've been there. Thank you for your question.
In your opinion, like, what kind of leadership do you feel like you're building? Because I am a 23-year-old voter here in Chicago Register. Yeah. And when I look at you, I don't see the kind of leadership that I want to have in or that I want to be. Okay. And so what legacy are you leading for yourself?
So I'm not sure I know how to answer your question because I'm not sure I understand it.
At the community level, your constituents don't feel like Ms. Banks said, they don't feel like they know you, like they've seen you. I personally have been phone making and knocking on doors, and we have been fussed out many a times because they say they don't hear from politicians until it's time to be voted in, which means your constituents have not heard from you. And that's throughout your district, not just certain communities.
Yeah, so
I'm just wondering, what is your legacy? Because you say all these things, but your constituents don't know you, they don't trust you, so really you can't make a change if you're not doing something at the community level.
Well, sure, ma'am. Once again, I think that that both of you have spoken for yourselves, and I appreciate your opinion on that. I don't agree with that because I'm out here every day and I'm making hours of calls a day, and that's not what I'm hearing. So what I would say, I'm telling you that your opinion is not one that I agree with. That's what I'm telling you. And what I'm saying is that legacy is what you actually get done. And I've listed and could list again the things that I've gotten done in just 1 year in Springfield, thanks to the support of my constituents and the good people that I've been able to build coalition and work with. So I happen to disagree with you.
I got a question. I just want to ask you, what do you see as the root cause of youth violence here in the city of Chicago? And how have you begun to work?
So it's multiple factors, right? So part of it is that you've got a situation where I think I saw a number from Jack Weiss a couple of days ago that said the unemployment rate for black teens was like 93% in 2012. So I think that's a huge problem, making sure that we actually have opportunities that actually pay our youth to stay off the street and actually get some job skills that they're not going into high school or college without them. So I think that's one part. I think that a lack of job opportunities for adults in terms of local role models is difficult. One thing I'll say that I've worked on, so I'm the child of a single mom, as I said. And in part, I got lucky growing up because my grandparents were around, even though they were sick, and so that was kind of free child care while my mother was working the night shift. And so I've sponsored a bill at the state level that's coming into committee, I think, next week, that actually raised the child care eligibility gap to say that if you can be 200% above the poverty line and still get a reasonable subsidy from the state of Illinois. So I'm single mom X, and I no longer have to make the choice, as so many moms in my district do now, to either take this job that can finally kind of get me enough income to get over the hump, start saving, or do I take care of my kid who I love? I think it's a false choice that no one should have to make. So I think that that's one concrete example of kind of working on that. And I think that when you talk about youth violence, it really is kind of this elixir of the fact that, you know, our families have been under duress for many, many years. And in part, it's a great deal that has to do with unemployment. A lot of it has to do with growing up around violence and the kind of psychological effects that has. And there's severe underreporting of mental health issues in the Black community. And I think that, you know, making sure we increase funding and appropriations for mental health is going to help with that as well. So I know it's kind of a long answer, but I think it's a multi-part question that requires a multifaceted approach. That doesn't even count the effect the prison industrial complex has on removing Black fathers from the home. So that's part of the reason why I'm working so hard on, you know, doing more to make sure that we're not over-penalizing drug offenders, those sorts of things.
My name is Abram Hackman, and I would like to go back to the pension. And one of the concerns I have about the pension is that I'm a young person just getting into depositing into the pension. There are seniors that have already deposited into the pension. Based on what I've heard you say today, that you voted to slash the pension so you could save money so it wouldn't all be taken away. Is that what you said? Or?
No, that's your characterization.
Misinterpreted. I'm here just to ask
you
a question.
I hear you. Okay. So I'm saying I hear your characterization. What I'm saying is we were going toward a death spiral, mm-hmm. both financially in a literal financial sense and also in terms of the political situation that was beginning to form.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did preserve defined benefit plans in the state of Illinois. And that what I would also say, and this is the thing I didn't say in my first answer, is we have to now pivot toward the discussion, and Will alluded to this before, of how we got here in the first place. And the way we got here in the first place is this odd structure we have in Illinois where two-thirds of corporations pay no income taxes, where the middle-class families, so folks making, let's say, between $35,000 and $75,000 a year, when you count sales taxes, property taxes, pass-through taxes on paying for a gallon of gas, are paying twice as much as a share of their income as the top 1%. And that's both broken and unfair and also really bad for our economy. So we have to pivot on that. We also have to look at the sales tax base that was kind of came up in an agrarian time that only taxes goods and not services. And if we look at shifting those revenues in a way that makes sure the wealthy are paying their share, we prevent ourselves from getting here ever again. We create the kind of economic activity that makes sure that our retirees have more income in their pockets and that our active workers have more money in their pockets. And that's how we avoid the situation going forward. But because of the situation we found ourselves in, because of decisions that people made for years before I got into office, politicians and leaders of interest groups alike, we had to do something. And if we did not, the situation would be significantly worse than it is now. That's what I'm saying.
Now, the other thing also, I'd like to just ask the question also. Did you make this vote based on that, or have you ever been given money to make sure that you voted that way? Because, I've read literature that implies that that's what you did. Mm-hmm. And if that's what you did, I have a concern about if you would sell my pension off that cheap, there's no telling what you might do. I'm just asking a question. Is this true?
Let me answer your question. So
did any special interest group give you any money to make sure you vote that way?
No.
Okay.
No, that's not the case. And while I understand that came from the campaign pinned on your chest, that is, in fact, not the story. The story is I made the decision I made because it was in the ultimate best interest of my constituents based on making sure the retirement security would exist. That's why I did what I did. I didn't like it, but I did it because ultimately it had to be done. Thank you for your question.
All right. At this time, we are going to wrap up the portion of questions for Christian Mitchell. So one last round of applause for our next question. Now we'll be introducing our fourth speaker, Jay Travis. But Jay Travis is from North Kenwood. She's organizing Kenwood Oakland Community Organization. And she has a bachelor's from Columbia University. Columbia College. I'm so sorry. Once again, let's give it up for Jay Travis.
Thank you all for having this event. And thank you all for pushing for not only yourselves, but people throughout this city and state to be more informed as we make decisions about who lead us. Please don't take the heaviness in my voice as any other sign other than I've been using my voice a lot lately. So please bear with me. When in 2004, when my community was targeted to have 20 of 22 of its neighborhood schools closed, I worked side by side with youth leaders, with parents, with educators to resist those policies, because I knew then what the data shows now, which is 80% of the students affected by school closings were forced into other schools that have not outperformed their schools of origin. They had their education disrupted. The people who live in my community, who worked in those schools, had their employment disrupted. And the premise was that this would be better for the education of students in our community. We knew then it was wrong. We resisted it, and we pushed for evidence-based reform so that what is currently working in schools could be brought to scale in schools that educate Black and Latino children. So that regardless of your race or income, you would have an opportunity to attend a well-resourced school with an intellectually challenging curriculum that didn't have to succumb to policies at the state level that force the curriculum to be geared toward teaching to the test. We pushed for those things. We pushed for those things then. I walked in my community with a clipboard for years, pushing for an elected representative school board. How many of you been to a Chicago public school board meeting? How many of you been down there? Did you feel as if that appointed school board heard your voice, heard your pain about one of the basic rights we should have in our neighborhood, which is to have a neighborhood school that's well-resourced within walking distance of our house? No, those people didn't hear our interests. But a decision at the state level, just as a decision about school closings can be made at the state level. These are the decisions that Will is talking about. This is it's a very, very serious time for us. When our grandparents, parents, uncles, and aunts paid into their pension systems, they didn't take a pension holiday. They didn't take time off. They paid into those systems. They earned those benefits. And many of those people are part of the backbone of the economies of our communities. Proposals that could have gone forward. This was not the only choice that was available. How do you, I want to speak about my opponent a little bit, because how do you stand here and say, well, now it's time to get to the root cause of the issue? You should have been about the business of getting to the root cause of the issue from the start. Made decisions for decades not to change the tax structure to generate the revenue that the state needed to cover the cost of public services. That structural deficit is what should have been addressed.
That's right.
First and foremost. But then you got all of these corporate interests, like Will mentioned, the We Mean Business PAC, and these billionaires who have framed this issue around pensions to be these greedy grandmas and grandpas who paid into the system versus the legislators that refused to make the difficult decisions about the tax structure. $6 billion was spent on the pension systems in fiscal year 2014. Of that $6 billion, $5 billion was to pay down the debt that had been generated from those holidays. But people don't expect us to be able to connect the dots. I'm somebody who's born, raised, and educated in the neighborhoods that make up the 26th district. I've pushed back against mass school closings. I've fought side by side with youth organizations throughout the state to win Public Act 1225 to fund youth employment initiatives at the state level, creating over 8,000 jobs. I am somebody who's pushed with youth organizations throughout the city to end 2-week mandatory 2 weeks suspensions, changing, you know, CPS school discipline code. I'm somebody with a track record. When Christian sat here and talked about working on the Olympics, he sat at the table I led.
Talk about it.
He sat at the table I led. Forming the CEO Coalition and pushing for a benefits agreement so that our neighborhood wouldn't experience the same level of displacement that other cities who hosted the games experienced. I want to talk a little bit about that circle that Will talked about, because it's important. And it's not about, you know, saying things that are disparaging as much as it is about bringing clarity. The We Mean Business PAC is funded by people like Bruce Rauner. They've been completely clear about their desire to gut public pension funds. Christian took $17,000 from that PAC. And to say that there's a, you know, I don't know what motivates folks, but to say that there's a disconnect between that money and that decision, you go figure. I don't know. He's taking $100,000 from Stand for Children. Stand for Children is an organization that's explicitly clear about their desire to link high-stakes testing to teacher evaluations, to reduce the collective bargaining rights of teachers. Completely clear. But I'm supposed to believe that his decision not to sign on to the moratorium to stop the last round of school closings had nothing to do with the fact that he's taking all this money from Stand for Children. We're here tonight because enough is enough. We're here tonight because we want leadership that is accountable to the constituents that put them in office, simply put. I'm a leader that has a track record of standing firm on these issues. I will be a leader in Springfield that will continue to be a champion for these issues, working with you all to make sure the people that are most impacted have a strong voice in the policy process. And that's, I can open it up for questions and answers.
I'm one of the youth that benefited from Public Act 1225, which was the summer youth employment bill. And I would like Ms. Travis just to explain more about the bill.
Well, essentially, we worked and we passed Public Act 1225 in 2010. We're pushing each year. The governor's office and agencies like DHS use the framework of our bill to fund youth employment initiatives. But in state, as a state legislator, I would really push to make sure that that bill is fully appropriated. This bill was passed because young people in neighborhoods like Kenwood, Oakland, Pilsen, Albany Park were disappointed at the decrease in funding that came from the federal level to support youth employment initiatives. We formed a coalition, and we successfully advocated to have that bill passed, and I'm very proud of that work. Now it's time to make sure that work is realized through a full appropriation for that bill so that, yes, it's great that they use it as a framework each year, but it needs to be fully appropriated so that young people in our communities that desire to work are able to work during summer months.
Could you tell us, do you know how many years have gone by that the state did not adequately put their portion of the funds into the pension system that led to this fiasco?
This has happened through the years for decades, Mr. Travis. It's a problem that the state got into over time. It goes back. When I think about when they put the pension wrap in place in the late 80s, it was already a long pattern of the state not paying what it should have been paying into the system. So in addition to not paying what it should have been paying into the system, the state established a pension wrap that said by 2045 that the pension funds had to be at least 80% solvent. But by taking those holidays and not paying in the amount that they should have been paying in over time, it just exacerbated or made the problem much worse.
So then it's wrong to point the finger at the retirees and the workers.
Yeah, right. And the root you're right. And the root cause of that gets to why did the state divert that money away from the pension funds in the first place? It was diverting that money away in a rob Peter to pay Paul fashion, which gets to the state's structural deficit and the need for leadership around addressing that issue.
Hello, I wanted to ask you the same question. What do you want your legacy to be? And I want to explain that I asked that question because to me that means what is your vision? If you don't have a vision, then you don't have a standard by which you are in the room making those decisions by. So you will be swayed by money and things and such. But I want to know, what is your legacy? What do you want to have accomplished by the time, you know, you may not be here, and we, of course, expect that to be a long time from now, but that's what I want to know.
Okay. I would want my legacy to be a person who made sure that the political process addressed the needs of the people, and I would love to be a part of a cohort of people to bring that into reality. That's what I would like my legacy to be. I want to be a leader who helps to shift this political landscape in a way that tilts it back toward democracy. Yeah. And that tilts it back toward bringing the people back into the process. That's what the special interest in that circle that Will mentioned, the scale has to be tilted so that the interests of the people are addressed first and foremost. And that's what I would like my legacy to be. And I also would like to make sure that in my lifetime, part of my work is making sure that children throughout the city and state have access to the education that I had as a young person, just a few blocks from my door. I think that it's shameful that African American students are about 40% of the CPS population, but 80% of the students who've been impacted by school closings. So those are two key things that I would like in terms of my vision.
Thank you. Christian mentioned that if they hadn't voted on the pension bill, it would have been catastrophic. You had alluded to the fact that there were other options. Mm-hmm. I know that Senator Cullerton's bill never made it once to the House floor, and I've heard state legislators say that if that bill had been brought up, it would have passed. When the current pension bill is thrown out in court, because there are four or five lawsuits now, I know one's been consolidated, they've consolidated some of them, will you support a version that is similar to Senator Cullerton's bill, or will you do some of the things that Will's been talking about and try to avoid having to even do a pension bill?
I think that and thank you too for that, because my first goal would be to address the state's revenue question. I think that that's the core of the issue. It's been framed. People have spent millions of dollars to frame the state's debt issues as a pension issue. And when you really break down the normal cost of pensions at about $1 billion a year, you can see that $5 billion had to do with the debt. So we need to address the state's structural deficit, and that's what I would make one of my tasks, hopefully working with Will to do so. And that involves, I think, the fair tax structure, which I also support.
So just a little context here. I was one of the marriage equality advocates, and many of us kind of have, like, sort of a commitment to stay out of the races. I don't know if you guys have heard that, but it's true, I'll be honest. And some of the frustrations about Christian are really true. I would say that as well. It's similar to Will, whereas you have a legislature where there's sort of a machine that goes on, right? How do you change that, right? It's not just your vote, but really bringing other people and like-minded thinkers, you know, to the legislature with you. How do you sort of form coalition both in and outside of the legislature to be able to accomplish some of these things that are really difficult? How do you see that? How do you see that happening? Yeah.
You know, I think in several ways. One, I think recently African-American legislators pulled together and they called for a procedural move around the question of mandatory minimums that stopped that bill in its tracks. Mm-hmm. That coalition of people, you know, had Mike Madigan saying, well, a session is closed. They're walking out. It can be done. I think that you have to be ready to push against the status quo to do it. Also, when you look at bills like the bill for the moratorium to stop the last round of school closings, you saw that there were about 30 legislators that signed on. You get the sense there are 53 people in the House that didn't vote for the pension bill. There are some opportunities there. I think that we just need more people there that really help to organize to move a more progressive agenda. So there, I can point to those as recent examples, and I would want to be a part of those kinds of conversations to build the kind of coalitions that we need. It can be done. When the African-American legislators did the piece with the procedural move, a lot of folks in our community are like, yes, that's what we've been waiting on. It's time for that kind of clarity and unison. So I think it's hope there. I think it's hope there. It's about getting the change agents in the mix to edge that on a little bit more.
Thank you for sharing your views with us. We really appreciate you being here. I understand your vision on education, public education. I understand your love for young folks, especially. What I would love for you to share a little bit is, so there's a lot more bills, education bills that come to your desk, right, when you get granted. Other things like TIF, but a lot of your answers go back to education. And I understand that you're going to be a champion, you are a champion.
Right.
So what else?
Oh, yeah, what else? Are there absolutely.
Of other bills that are not education bills? Right?
Oh, in terms of the things that I care about with regard to employment, I definitely want to make sure that we get the kind of economic development in our community, particularly in the 26th district, because some of the zip codes have unemployment rates that are triple that of the national average. I want to make sure that we strengthen support for the small businesses in the area that want to hire locally so that they can give me money of the resources they need to hire, particularly in those high unemployment areas. I also want to strengthen state laws around TIFs. There's a lot of, in terms of how TIFs are sort of divvied up, that's a municipal issue. But in terms of the usage of TIFs that's stated in state law, there needs to be some, I think, tightening up so that you don't have that loophole. You know, it says we should use it for blight, if not but for. We might need to tighten up that if not but for so that we make sure that these dollars are being used in ways that aren't just slush funds for aldermen so we can get the kind of economic development we need to hire people again locally. I care deeply about public safety and making sure that we get to the root causes of public safety by making sure that people within our community that want to work can work and that we stop many of the push out and zero tolerance policies that have many of our young people on the streets when many of them would like to be in the classroom, and many of these folks are young folks that need the most support. So, I mean, I care about economic development and job creation. I care about public safety, but from an angle of getting at the root causes of what causes our communities to be less safe. I also care a lot about education. I mentioned that. Then I also care about making sure that the retirement security of long-term stakeholders in our community are protected. So those are some of the things that I'm sorry if I kind of went from an education piece. Those are things that I care about deeply as well.
We've been down to Springfield several times about schools and about senior housing and about seniors individually, and I was wondering, does it make any difference that a group of people come down there and get in their faces and they still pass the bills they want to pass?
Yes, sir. I think, Mr. Rallup, that gets to accountability, which is part of what this race is about, making sure that the elected officials that are there to represent us are actually addressing our needs. So I agree. And senior housing, you know, is somebody, I'm from the community, I've pushed a great deal to ensure that the housing in which our community's treasures and long-term stakeholders live in is safe and decent.
So a question to point something out. This gentleman here asked a question to Christian about whether or not we need business PAC had donated money, or rather given money to Christian. And Christian said no. You happen to say that you took $17,000 from the We Need Business for his campaign.
Yes.
I think he wasn't answering the question directly from this gentleman. How do you feel about the kind of character that recognizes that kind of question not being pointed directly and answers it in such a way that they knowingly are misleading the group that's in front of them.
Well, you know, the beautiful thing about finances in terms of who's funding a campaign is you could go to the Illinois Board of Elections, you could hit contributions, and then you could see who's, because I was shocked. I was looking at the D2, and I'm like, the We Mean Business package right here giving the man the money? I mean, I can't believe it. So I think that was just not honest. Simply put, that was just not honest. He accepted the money from the We Mean Business PAC, which is funded by Bruce Rauner, and he voted accordingly. And there should be some accountability for that. And that gets to what Will so eloquently laid out with that circle of interest.
Yes.
You know, I didn't have to go into it because he taught it masterfully. Who's influencing the decisions that these legislators are making? You know, and I appreciate your question. That just was not honest.
I'm sorry. The people that's funding these PACs are the strong politicians in Chicago. I was born here 72 years, so I know all about it. I've been voting since I was 18. I'm a lifelong Democrat. and I can tell you about Madigan and all of them, Preckwinkle and all of that group, that's who funded it. That's who funded it. She's more powerful than people ever know. She's funding most of these 26 districts in the black wards. She controls that. So that's who funding it. I'm speaking it out of my mouth, nobody else's. Preckwinkle.
Definitely the establishment.
When we went to Springfield, we asked Christian Mitchell to support elected school board, and he told us absolutely not. Now, also, we asked him to vote to start a moratorium on school closing.
Yes, sir.
He said he would, but when he voted against it. He voted the other way. Now he's running on education platform as though he's doing a whole lot and haven't done anything.
Yes, sir.
My question is to you, if a group of people come to you out of your district and ask you to support a certain bill that you feel is reasonable, would you tell them yes and turn around and vote the other way because of the special interests or whoever?
No, sir. No, sir. That was not acceptable. I think what Representative Mitchell said to many people in the community was that he would support a hybrid board, and the hybrid board would allow the mayor to still appoint the majority of the school board members, which means that people still wouldn't have the power to influence the decisions at the board level.
I have one question. When Christian Mitchell came in late, why was he called before Jay Travis when she's been waiting all this time? Is there a reason? Were they supposed to go in a particular order?
Okay. I wasn't expecting many questions, but...
That's just right.
And the reason I'm asking this is that I don't know. We know who Christian Mitchell represents. We know that Christian Mitchell is a liar.
Yes.
We do know that. And we're asking all of these questions of Jay Travis that, you know, about what Christian Mitchell is doing. We know that he is a part of the system. Mm-hmm. We know that he is a puppet.
Yes.
And no one wants to call him a puppet. And we know that we have fresh new people here that are trying to, you know, break that democratic link. Everything here is a connection. And we're asking them all of these questions in which they're not going, one thing I like is they're not going to make us promises. They're not making promises like other politicians that come from the regular system is making. All they're saying is what their hopes are and what they're working for. These are the new young people that need to be elected to get rid of the democratic system with all of the lying, all of the, like they're saying, for instance, she's having a, a tax. I got a thing in the mail that says she's for upping the taxes. That's not what she said. You know, and on that, I'm just saying, why are we questioning them? They're telling us that we want to change the system. They want to work with the community. The powers that be don't work with the system. They work with all the money that's in my neighborhood, and that's all I want to say. And all these questions that we're asking are the things that we would like for them to do, and they've already promised they'll do what they can and work with the constituents and the community.
In response to that question, that was under my purview. When I had scheduled the event, Christian's people had specifically mentioned that they would want to go on before Jay Travis, and they more recently this morning informed me that they would be leaving at a certain time. So okay. That was the allocated schedule. There was no, I want to make sure there was no, that you guys understand there was no favoritism. We are nonpartisan.
No, I know that. But that's the only way you could get him here, was that he could go for Jay Travis.
That was his suggestion.
Yeah.
I would like to move on to this man's question.
Yeah.
And one more question to get back in, wrapping it up.
Can you tell us how you feel about a couple things? Term limits, and what would you do to reform campaign finance? And in particular, what would you do to end the term of one Michael Madigan?
To be perfectly honest, I am forming an opinion on term limits. You know, I started out feeling like the voice of the people should determine how long someone serves. And we do have a few public servants that are doing a good job. And so I'm thinking, you know, if you have term limits, that might eliminate an opportunity for some of those folks that are doing a decent job to be there doing a good job. But I do understand the challenge of the 30-plus syndrome that exists. Particularly, I saw a picture of Mike Madigan, and he was so young, and they said this was the picture of when he went in, and I'm thinking, oh, my God. I mean, to see him now, it's ridiculous. So I'm going to be perfectly honest. He indicates the need for it. I'm trying to figure out my position on it in light of the people that are there that are doing a decent job. So I'm forming that. I'll probably have to have some deep discussion with people in district about it to get a sense of the pulse of the district on that issue. And then I'll be moving to make a decision. Because I've gone both ways. I've gone, people are doing a good job, then I've gone, something should be able to be done about this. So I'm in the middle. I got to figure that out. We do need campaign finance reform. We need it badly. People are complaining because labor organizations throughout the state are supporting my campaign. They're upset about that. These are organizations made up of working people. They pay their dues. They have a process. You come in, you meet with them. They determine whether or not they're going to support you. Folks are mad about that. But the money that's poured into these races gets to be absolutely ridiculous. My opponent has raised over $600,000. You know, so we do need to reform that process because you have to, in order to be able to compete with someone who is raising that much money, you have to figure out ways to be competitive. I mean, we're running a heck of a grassroots ground campaign.
Yes.
But the way that the financing work right now means that you have to raise so much even to be able to remotely compete. So I would push for campaign finance reform. We should be able to figure out ways to get our message out that don't require all of that money pouring in. $600,000. That's just too much. So I would definitely push for campaign finance reform. Absolutely.
All right.
You know, I'm kind of hoping that Ms. J and Will can kind of riff on this together, because I can't really see how they work together, the two progressive champions that hopefully we elect. But too often, I think the debate around public education has been defined by what you're against. I'm interested in what the two of you, you know, I'm really appreciative that you fought for the suspension adjustments. You know, I'm interested to hear what the two of you want to do to change public education so that we can break down the opportunity gap and make sure that we're educating black and brown children in ways that aren't funded by corporate ed reform.
Absolutely. I think that we have to push for what I call sustainable school transformation. And I think it's important that we push for this and we figure we put it in policy, because we can push to raise the foundation level that provides money for students, but I don't want to raise money that's going to go into more bad reform. So if we don't figure out a way to stop the agenda that's shifting more toward privatization, then that's exactly what we would be doing. So sustainable school transformation for me is very simple. One, making sure that we have policies in place that allow for content-focused, intellectually stimulating curriculum. We have to do something about these policies that promote assessments that drive teaching to the test in classrooms. Mm-hmm. That's limiting what our young people have an opportunity to learn. I think we also have to push for more opportunities for a better school environment that include opportunities for teachers to collaborate, so that teachers that have become master teachers have an opportunity, a real opportunity, to take newer teachers under their wing and help assist them.
That's right.
We also need wraparound supports for students.
That's absolutely
right. In our schools, we got students that come into schools that are facing numerous challenges. Difficult to focus if you're hungry, if you've got issues at home. We need more wraparound supports for our students. And we need opportunities for meaningful parental engagement. We have to protect our local school councils. We have to protect that part of school reform that allows the people from the community and parents to have a voice in what happens in our schools. So, and then, of course, in tandem, we need to push for equitable school funding. We also have to stop closing schools.
That's right.
If, you know, don't tell me over 100,000 people got moved out of the city when the political elite's children are in the school where it's in the contract that you can't have more than 24 students in the class.
That's right.
You know, so school closings are a failed practice. We have to stop that.
That's right.
No secret, I've known Jay most of my adult life. Worked with Will around the elected school board. So I'm excited about the possibility of, well, not the possibility, the inevitability of two people like you all being the spray thing. So my first, the question I want y'all to answer after I finish this first question is, how can people in the room help, right? So I think we need to put that out there, because we know we're in the stretch run. But what I'd like to ask you, Jay, is when you became the director of COCO, you were one of the youngest executive directors in the city. You had to deal with sexism, racism, ageism, just by any other ism. And you also had to deal with an organization that was struggling.
Right.
And I want people to understand, maybe you can share with people, how you changed COCO from being a paternalistic organization where what the former director said went to how we became an organization that was truly collaborative, where our agenda was driven. So when people talk about accountability, you know, it's easy for people to use that as rhetoric, but you lived it.
That's right.
And you created an organization that was truly accountable to the people in the neighborhoods. If Ms. Jones said we're going back in that meeting, we're going back in that meeting. And I just want you to talk to people about how you lived that.
Well, you know, simply put, when I came into COCO, you know, COCO had been an organization that had been around and won significant change. When I came back, unfortunately, it had lost a lot of its community support. What did we do? We hit doors. We went out. We talked to people. And we found out what people cared about and what they wanted to see on COCO's agenda. And we were accountable to those people based on those issues on that agenda. That's the only way I know how to do it. And over time, we built more relationships, we built more trust, and we rebuilt our membership base based on being accountable to people. I mean, Jeetu just mentioned the situation. I can remember we were in a heated education meeting, and I had asked the group to step in the hallway. And we got in the hallway, and COCO leaders circled me and said, "We're going back in." I know who I'm accountable to. We went back in. So, you know, it's about making sure that the people most impacted by the issues have a voice in setting the agenda of the organization. And in the public policy process, making sure that the people most impacted have a clear voice in the policy formation process. So, I appreciate your question.